Welcome to the Misfit Stars podcast. I'm Shannon Curtis.
And I'm Jamie Hill. Hi, listeners. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Jamie.
How you doing?
I'm okay.
Right on. Later on in this episode, people, we are going to be talking about how our country has been responding to current events. Spoiler alert, not amazing, but we want to talk about it a bit.
Broad strokes. Oh, but also later on in this episode, we're starting a new series this week.
Yes.
Where we're going to take a deep dive into each song on our new record, which came out last Saturday.
Yeah.
And Her Whisper Becomes a Storm.
Yes, it does.
And so we're going to start with song one on the album, and we're going to work our way each song, a song a week for the next 12 weeks, because there's 12 tracks on the record.
This is like a quarter year long project.
It really is.
I like it.
And we're going to talk about each song on its own. What is it, you know, where did it come from? What does it mean to us? Some of the technical stuff.
Yeah.
We also have some fun stuff to talk about regarding Jamie's bad lyric interpretations of some of my songs.
This is a hallowed tradition around our house. I try to make a point of mishearing Shannon's lyrics and then just singing them that way over and over and over.
So you're going to get to have a window in on that part of our world, which is going to be really fun.
Although the first song's an instrumental.
It's
so,
true.
You know,
so there won't be any bad lyrics
not
today.
Not too much to work with there for me, sadly.
But we'll start that series after the break in today's podcast as well. So there we go.
Right on. So hey, people, here's the deal. Misfit Stars is a community-centered endeavor. So what does that mean? As with everything else in our lives, Shannon and I are using this podcast as a vehicle to aggregate a community. We do that with our music, we do that with our online stuff, and we do that with this podcast. So that takes a couple of different forms. First of all, as with everything we do, we use this as an in for people who want to find a way to support the work that we do in the world. So if you like the work we do in the world and you want to be part of supporting it, you can go to misfitstars.com/join and you can become a supporting member, not unlike NPR or something, only a lot less expensive. It's like a $5 a month buy-in. I mean, you can do more if you're wealthy. Please do more if you're wealthy. But, you know, it's a way for people to say, yeah, I want to throw my lot in a small way with Shannon and Jamie and show that I support them and literally help support them as they do the work they do in the world. So if that describes you, please go to misfitstars.com/join. We will invite you to our private Facebook group, our private Misfit Stars group. Oh, it's the best. It's the safest place on the internet. You know, no one's an asshole. It's great. You'll love it. We can discuss sensitive topics and we can learn together in a vulnerable and mutually supportive way in there. And we do it all of the time. It's great.
That's the energy everyone's bringing to it. And it really makes a difference.
So
really
if that doesn't describe you, if you're the kind of person who's like, you know what? I like to go out on the internet and be a dick. Please do not go to misfitstars.com/join. Frankly, you wouldn't be welcome in the group. We wouldn't like it. However, most people I think who listen to the Misfit Stars podcast are very much not like that. You're very much the other way, which is to say gentle, vulnerable, kind, and supportive of other people who want to be the same way.
Mm.
So if this does describe you, please consider becoming a supporting member. We would love to have you on board.
You can do it at misfitstars.com/join.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And hey, while you're on the internet doing stuff regarding Misfit Stars, why don't you head on over to Apple Podcasts and click 5 stars and then leave a glowing review. It would help the podcast get into the ear holes of people who like the things you like, and that would help us, and we'd be grateful. Thanks.
Yeah, you know what? I actually did an interview with somebody earlier this week. Mm-hmm. She wanted to interview me about the new album, but she told me during our interview that she first heard about us via this podcast.
That feels so backwards to me.
Which is great. And so what I'm wanting to say here is that when you go and you leave these reviews on Apple Podcasts, it does help Apple actually get this podcast into the ear holes of people who might like it, like this woman who interviewed me about our new record because of the podcast.
That's amazing.
Which is great.
It just feels so backwards and improbable. It's like someone learning about Albert Einstein because he was a bicycle enthusiast and then discovering he also did science. You know what I mean?
Hey, however it works. We'll take it.
Yeah.
We'll take it. So awesome. Yes, yeah. Definitely do that. So I'll start with the how are we feeling question to you today, Jamie Hill. How are you feeling?
You know, thanks for asking. As I was sharing with you just before the podcast, apropos of absolutely nothing, I'm just feeling a little bit anxious today. And it's one of those I don't have any good reason for it
sure.
sorts of feelings. Nothing is wrong. I mean, specific to me. Everything is wrong, yeah. generally. And it's entirely possible, maybe even probable, that that's where the anxiety is coming
sure.
from. Because in absence of any specific stimulus, I tend just to assume that I am internally freaking out about how things are going in our country. Because,
yeah.
you know, they're not great.
Yeah.
They're not going amazing. You know, it's easier, though, when you have a specific source of anxiety because you can tackle it. You know what I mean?
You can name it. You can put your finger on it.
Yeah, and you can yeah. do specific, like, work around it, you know? It's mm-hmm. harder to do the work when it's nonspecific. I do still have tools, but it's just a lot harder when it's abstract and ambiguous
yeah.
than when it's something I can be like, this specific thing is going wrong, and because of that, I can address that specific
yeah.
thing, you
yeah.
know? It's harder when it's just... You know, everything feels a little bit fraught and on fire, but also not in any way that particularly like relates to me right now in this moment.
Yep.
It's just hard.
I totally get it. And I relate to what you're feeling. I was starting to share with you before the podcast today also that I don't feel anxious right now in this moment, but mm-hmm. I have been sort of, I feel like battling against the waves of that coming at me,
mm-hmm.
specifically in where my anxiety will typically manifest is at night, like during my sleep, you know? And so like I'll wake up and if I'm feeling anxious about something, I'll wake up and my brain will start spinning on whatever it is I've got to do or mm-hmm. that I'm worrying about or whatever. And I don't have anything particular to worry about or mm-hmm. I don't have like, you know, tasks that are weighing on me to do either. Like, so the past couple early mornings, like hours before it's time for me to wake up mm-hmm. for realsies, I found my brain starting to go down that road. Like, there's probably something that I should be working out in my brain right now and thinking mm-hmm. about and like solving problems. And there's not. And so I've been having to fight against that wave and like really choose to like, no, I don't need to be thinking about anything right now. I don't need to be spinning. So I understand sort yeah. of where you're coming from. For me, I was wondering actually if part of this for me, this feeling has been because the last few weeks for us have been so go, 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 go.
Mm-hmm.
Prepping for the album launch, getting all of the rehearsal and tech stuff figured out for our Zoom concerts.
So much to figure
there
out.
There was a constant barrage
yeah.
of stuff to do.
It kept us happily busy.
Well, I mean, yes, busy. But then once we started the tour and the album launched, we didn't hit a brick wall, but it was something of a sudden stop from all of that motion before.
Sure.
And we know from experience that normally that kind of thing happens when we end a tour,
yeah.
right? We come home from tour and we've been go, go, go with schedule every day and da, 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 da. And then we come home and it feels like just the sudden stop. And oftentimes we don't know exactly, like our emotional map kind of gets all jumbled,
yeah.
you know, because yeah. of that. And so I wonder if it's a similar kind of thing. Like we've reached the end of a period that was super intense
mm-hmm.
and that our brains are conditioned to be like thinking about what's next and be on it and on it and on it. And now that we don't really have a lot of that pressure,
mm-hmm.
I wonder if our brains are still catching up to
that's interesting.
To a new pace.
That's
you know
interesting.
What I mean?
It could be that same kind of end
yeah.
of tour weirdness.
Yeah. And that's
it's like
not,
they say about, you know, jumping off a building. It's not the fall that kills you, right? It's the sudden change in velocity at the very end of the process.
So that's probably part of it, I'm guessing. And also, yeah, of course, there's so much ambient stress still in the world.
Sure.
And there's still, you know, for the foreseeable future, going to be an extra layer, multiple layers of stuff that those of us who are committed to being engaged in the world
mm-hmm.
are going to have to be carrying,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that is both good and bad, right? Like, you know, you mentioned earlier, stuff's not going great, kind of out there. That said, like, it's both and, right? Yeah, there's some stuff that's pretty terrible,
mm-hmm.
but it's also, those same things are also opportunities for some real change making that could be also really great.
Yeah, for sure.
You know? So yeah, so it's all that too.
Right on.
It's all that.
Yeah, so I think that we just covered how are you feeling.
Oh, did you not finish what you had to say about that?
No, I'm not saying that. Oh. I'm more saying I did, and I just want to make sure, did you have anything else that you want to say about how you're feeling? Because it seemed like we just segued into that in a smooth way.
We did, and I'm good. Yeah, thanks for checking in.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It seemed like we covered it, but I just wanted to make sure.
No. Great. I just wanted to make sure that you got to finish what you wanted to say.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, I'm good. Okay. I'm good. I'm not good. But I'm, you know, I have said the things I need to say about that. And I'm okay, too. Totally. You know, I don't want to, like, overstate it. Like, I'm a little bit anxious. I'm not at, like, a 5-alarm fire freak out over here.
Yes.
I'm at, like, a 1-alarm, like, just a little heightened sense of just something fluttering at the back of my neck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Definitely.
Just a little unease.
But
I'm okay.
It's okay.
Yeah. So our experience this week. So, yeah, we made a massive transition this week from all of the stuff that happened before tour to now being on tour.
Which is a weird word to use for something that we're doing that involves us going down to our basement each night and not actually getting in our car and going anywhere.
Strange times.
On tour, in quotes.
Yeah. It's very, very weird. But, you know, so two things happened. One, we got it off the ground, which, you know, we had lofty aspirations and goals. Like, we did one of these blue sky brainstorming sessions sort of at the very beginning when we learned the coronavirus was going to change everything. And we're like, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to do a Zoom tour with studio quality audio, which sounds so simple when you just write it down on paper.
Yeah.
Actually figuring out how to make that happen in a repeatable, predictable, and actually studio quality way was extraordinarily time consuming.
Yeah. And complicated. You guys, I have to just give Jamie a shout out. Did I do this last week? I might have done it last week, but I'll do it again. The amount of complexity of stuff that he had to put together to figure out how to make these Zoom concerts sound as incredibly great as they sound in a predictable fashion. Like it was incredible to see. Like I would never in a million years have been able to figure all of that out from a technical standpoint, from a sound engineering standpoint, from a, you know, computer technology, like all of it, It's incredible.
Oh,
those
thanks.
Of you who get to be part of one of our virtual house concerts, you'll get to experience the fruit of that.
It's pretty neat.
It's pretty cool. And you did an amazing job, honey.
Aw, well, hey, thanks. That means a lot. And you know, what's even more remarkable is that I did it essentially with stuff cobbled together that we had around the house.
I love that. Yeah. Yes. It was like the MacGyver of
bringing back old pieces of gear that were sitting in cupboards in the basement. You know what I mean? Old audio interfaces from 2004 and stuff. It works. I mean, it's still amazing gear. It's no longer the current stuff, but plug a couple of adapter cables together and all of a sudden we have an amazing sounding interface. You know, from the live rig to Zoom and
paper clips and duct tape all that. Yeah, it's really great.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. The basement looks amazing right now. It looks like a mad scientist's lab.
It totally is.
In the best way. Yeah. And it's so empowering feeling because we can just go down there and play music together and it will get beamed out over the internet in a really cool way for people to have an experience, an emotional connection with. You know? It's been really neat.
I have felt my body over the last number of days just like relaxing into this new rhythm. And a large part of that is just having had now the first three experiences with the house concerts. We did shows Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Mm-hmm. We're recording this on Tuesday. We have our fourth show tonight. But just doing all these shows, we had this idea about what they could be and what they might be.
We had hopes.
But we didn't know until we actually dove in. And honestly, these shows are absolutely outperforming my expectations of the level of intimacy.
I was going to say they're better than I had even imagined.
Yeah, I thought that we were going to be like trying to get somewhere on the same block as the level of connection that we normally get to have at in-person house concerts. And it's way more than that. Like it's a different experience, obviously, but the nature of like each person's face being right there on screen, looking into the camera the whole time, or looking into the shared virtual space. There's a lot more. I think it requires a lot more like personal buy-in from each person participating, and I feel like the result is that it's a really intense and intimate experience. Like, even though we're thousands of miles away from people in some cases.
Yeah, it's really great. And I think there's another dynamic at play, too, that I hadn't really thought about ahead of time, which is I think that maybe people are a little bit more emboldened to allow themselves to be seen being emotional and to be seen being vulnerable because they're not right in the same room person to person, but they're behind a computer screen over the internet. And I think my intuition is that it just seems like that's giving people a feeling of a little bit more safety somehow. Mm. Because people are being way more open than I would have guessed they would be.
It's wonderful.
It's kind of the opposite. Like you, I had kind of thought that we'd have to coax out the intimacy, coax out the vulnerability of the shared experience. And really, it seems like people are coming. Like, first of all, the audiences are smaller in the best possible way. Because what we don't have is the spouse who got drugged there against their will, but, well, screw it, I'll get drunk.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is for sure a dynamic, really, at any concert. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
And for sure at the house concerts, you know, there'll be, like, one person sometimes who's, like, so into it, so stoked to be there, and their partner who is like, this is going to be dumb.
I'm missing the game right now.
This is for girls, you know? Yeah. Emotions are for girls. And you know, and we can feel that weird energy in person there, and it doesn't help. It sort of works against what we're doing. But now it's great because, like, those people just don't have to get on screen.
Exactly.
They don't have to show up. They can be in another room watching the game.
And their
spouse, who wants to be the one being there, is just totally there, totally into it. And it's almost more their special thing for them.
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've been just wonderful. And I'm so excited that we just get to keep doing this summer. By the way, if you're listening to this and you're like, virtual house concert, what?
Oh, it's the best.
First of all, we are currently booking dates in August. Mm-hmm. If you want to share this experience with us.
It's like July through August, like the last week of July.
I'm saying August because most of those late July dates are kind of
they're
filling up. So,
okay.
So mostly it's August. If you want to share this with us and with your friends and your family members and people, your special people, we would love to do it. Just send one of us a message. We'll send you our host guide and the application.
It's dead simple.
It is. There's not, you don't have to clean your house.
No.
You don't have to prepare food.
No.
You don't have to get dressed.
Yeah.
If you don't want to. Show up in your bathrobe. Nobody cares.
Yeah. Look, there's two approaches and we've seen both. You can either clean your house or you can dim the lights.
Yeah.
Either way, it looks good on camera, you know?
And, that's right.
And really, we just send you a link that you and your people all click on at the pre-arranged date and time. It's that simple. You just click the link and you're in.
Yep. And also, if hosting a show and inviting people does not sound like your jam or not something that you're able to do at this time, totally get it. We'd still love for you to be a guest at a show. And we've got a lot of hosts who are open to inviting people outside their own social circles.
Yep.
And so just email, look at our tour schedule online, shannoncurtis.net/tour. Find a show or two that would work in your schedule and email Jamie and he'll coordinate with our hosts to see about getting you an invitation. So,
and if you're on there looking at shannoncurtis.net/tour, just on that first page, you'll be like, well, it doesn't say any of the times. Just click on any of the individual dates and you'll see the time and time zone.
Right.
And make sure to check that because we're not going in a linear fashion around the country because we're not doing this in a station wagon. We're doing it online, which is actually really fun. I started making a tour map.
I love it.
Which just has all these arrows zigzagging from the East Coast to the West Coast to Europe to the. It's wonderful. It's very hodgepodge. But make sure you do check the time zone because I would hate for you to think that you're coming to something that's at 7:30 p.m. and it's actually at 4:30 p.m. because you're on the wrong coast.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, but that's all good stuff.
So that's off the ground. The tour's off the ground, which is amazing. What that also means is that the 3 months of pre-tour prep are finished. All that stuff that we had to do since the beginning of coronavirus, which is basically like we had to reinvent our entire lives and all the ways in which we make money and then figure out how to do this tour thing. All of it had to be finished by Friday because that was the first show of tour. Well, it's after Friday, so it's all done. So really like this frenetic, just impossible, like, we took a day off yesterday. It was our first day off in 15 days because literally we didn't have time to take even a quarter of a day off for the last 2 weeks. That's how intense it got to get everything done. But now it's done.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, you know what it really reminded me of is the push toward exams like before winter break in college or something.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where it just gets more and more and more intense and harder and harder and harder and the workload gets more and you keep staying up later and later. But then it finishes. And everything is just cool. And all of a sudden, your schedule is like really normal again.
Right.
That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
So it's a big relief.
It is.
And now we're adjusting to a new normal of being on tour, which is just interesting, you know? It's neither good nor bad. I mean, I think it's really good.
It is.
The schedule part. But we're just getting used to it, you know? Because it's just a different schedule. It's not a good schedule or a bad schedule. I mean, it's a great schedule.
It is.
But schedules are neither, they're not inherently good or bad. They just are. And the question is, how do they intersect with like your other routines and ways of doing things on a day-to-day basis, you know? So far, it seems like it's working out fine. The thing that I really love is that, like, come 9:15 p.m., we're done work. Which yeah. I know for most people is like, wow, that's still really late. But usually we work until midnight.
Yeah.
And so to be done work at like 9:15, 9:30 is like, I sat on the couch the other night and read a magazine it's at 9:30 at night. I hadn't done that probably since, I don't know, February. It was wonderful.
Yeah, totally.
I could really see a lot more of that.
And other perks of being on tour, in quotations, from home, we get to sleep in our own bed every night.
Home-cooked meals. No foraging for weird food at whatever restaurant happens to be open at 11:45 p.m.
This is a small thing. Not having to pack up my toiletries in a little bag every day and take it to somewhere new. I could just open my medicine chest and, oh, there's my deodorant and my toothpaste. How nice.
Yeah.
Like, I know that seems like a stupid thing to point out, but it's really lovely for, you know, someone who's used to just packing up her whole life and, you know, having whatever she needs to survive in a bag. For months at a time. It's really great.
It's really true. No, it's good.
We, of course, are missing all of the in-person hugs, the hugs, you know, and the late night chats that we get to have with people. I will miss, you know, visiting those places that have become familiar to us on the road, you know, our favorite burrito place in Boise.
Yeah.
Our, you know, favorite, you know, creamy spot in Vermont, you know,
absolutely.
Just all those
favorite breakfast spot in Asheville, North Carolina.
Yeah, totally. Biscuit Head, by the way. But you know, so like all those little things I will miss. Although I think what will end up happening with that is that when we get to come back, and this will probably be true for so many things in our lived experience, not just, you know, tour, when we're able to go back out into the world like normal.
Yeah.
Again, those things will just feel a lot more sweet.
Yeah.
You know, I think that...
And when we're able to do them, and I might make a segue here into one of the things we were going to talk about.
Awesome.
When we're able to do so in a responsible way.
Yeah.
And in a way that's where we know that we and the other people in our communities and our lives are being taken care of. Like, that's when it's going to feel sweet and good.
Oh, yeah.
And I really want to draw a distinction between that and what's happening right now.
Right.
Which is a whole bunch of people just deciding to pretend like this isn't a thing and to quote unquote get back to normal.
Right. The virus isn't a thing.
Yeah, totally. And you know, Shannon and I spend some time on Twitter. It's a place to get, it's a place to get news. It's a place to get sort of dissection of things that are happening behind the news, you know, for better or for worse. It can be a hellhole too.
I use it a lot to be able to listen to voices that I want to learn from.
Absolutely.
People who are like, in particular in this time, a lot of Black activists, you know.
It's amazing for that.
That it's a great place to learn, but
Black Twitter people is like a whole thing.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, it really is. And like, if you want just to have a pipeline to what people are thinking in real time, it's the best place to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so in that spirit, there's a couple of things that I wanted just to kind of summarize because they felt to me really related. We read them both in the last 24 hours.
Yeah.
And this is under the general heading of, you know, how are we all doing as a society dealing with this virus right now, right? And so this one person, they're not like a quote-unquote checkmark account or anything. You know, they're no one famous. They're just a human who had a thought that I found interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They said, I'm still going to avoid bars, restaurants, gyms, retail, large crowds, protest is different, etc., until there's treatment or a vaccine. See you all in 2021. Very little of what's being done in these phased reopenings is living or intimate. It's consumption masked as purpose.
Oof.
Which just felt like a blow to my solar plexus when I read that, you know? Because, oh my gosh, how true, right?
Yeah.
Like, you don't need to eat at Applebee's or whatever. You know what I mean?
Right.
Consumption masked as purpose is just, you know, it's just the most insightful four words I think that I've maybe heard in months, you know? And then, you know, there was a second thing that I read.
Well, before you get into that, I remember an experience you and I had a couple months ago. Was it a couple months? I don't even remember. Time is elastic. But it was one of our first forays. It was our first foray back at Target.
Right.
Which we've only been to a couple of times. You know, we try to minimize our shopping and mm-hmm. like make it all on one, try to go to one spot or at least on one day, just go get it done, yeah. come home. Long list, get it all hammered out, right? Yeah. But we had to go to Target for something. And this was back before, this was back like, early days of like nothing was open really. Target was open because it was an essential mm-hmm. goods place, right, with like food and essential goods.
This would have been like in probably late March.
Yeah. And it was super empty inside. There was a line to get in. And then once you were in, it felt like we had the whole store to ourselves.
Seriously.
You know?
It was like 125,000 square foot store with like 100 yeah. people in it.
Yeah. And so it was really easy to be there. The last time I went, it was a different story. But yeah. But I remember we were like walking back up to from the food area to the cashiers, and we passed by some of the home goods, mm-hmm. you know, like the household, you know, decorations. Yeah. And you made the comment, it's just so nice to be around consumer goods.
Yeah.
And yes, it did.
It felt like, oddly comforting. And in the same breath, we were both like, that's maybe not good.
That's maybe something we should take a look at. Because yeah, I felt it too. You're like, yeah. oh, look, there's the Chip and JoJo line of decorative stuff.
Yeah.
And I love looking at this stuff.
I know them from the TV.
Yeah. Yeah. And it did feel oddly comforting.
Yeah.
And like you said, oddly comforting slash, oh no, what's wrong with me?
Yeah. comforting slash appalling.
Like, what is it about me that finds comfort in being among consumer goods? And I think it ties in with what this guy was saying on
sure.
Twitter, this idea of consumption maximizes purpose. How much of our lives have we allowed to be defined by what we consume?
Yeah.
And how much of it we consume? And I mean, that's a really profound thought that I think I need to chew on. We're bringing it up here on the podcast, and I'm not sure I have anything brilliant to say about it except for
probably should be thinking about that.
Need to think about that some.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So in my mind, it tied into this other thing I read, and I just read it this morning. And this is from somebody who's somebody in the world.
Everybody's a somebody, Jerry.
Right? Yeah. Let's get all Disney with it. This guy's name is Andy Slavitt. He's a healthcare expert. And so
he's been so helpful during this time of breaking down daily, here's what's going on regarding the coronavirus. Like ever since
yeah.
March, he's been such a great, steady source of information. And also, here's what you can be doing.
Yeah.
You know?
And so he had this this thread for people who don't know. It's a string of little thoughts put together because you can only fit so many characters into Twitter. So if you want to write something longer, you just got to break it up. And I'm just going to read some of this
okay.
to provide context. So here's what he says. He says, COVID update, June 22. In a lot of ways, COVID-19 is forcing us to answer the question, what kind of society are we?
Mm-hmm.
Which, first of all, I read that and I was like, huh, yeah, right? That's
yeah.
true. It's a mirror. This is a mirror.
Absolutely. And I remember thinking this at the very beginning of all this, like this is going to be an opportunity to take a look at ourselves.
Yep.
Right?
Totally true. And so he continues, particularly as the healthy, white, and well-off find ways to protect themselves, will we look out for each other? The pattern in the U.S. in all likelihood will be a pattern of cases going up, death rates going down, much more unequal outcomes.
Yeah.
As time goes on and the virus spreads, two things happen. One, our own behavior adapts to what we know, and two, scientists adapt to what we learn. Let's start with the scientists. Science is attacking four major problems right now: the virus, clotting, oxygen deprivation, and immune system overreaction.
Right.
Right? Those are the four things that science is dealing with. When the virus was in Wuhan, being on a ventilator was a death sentence. 80% of people on ventilators died. Today, that number is lower and getting lower still. With new therapies, that 80% could be more in the 20 to 40% range.
Wow.
And he continues, in a society where we look out for one another, this scientific and social adaptation could be good. But societies where many people largely look out for themselves will have a different outcome. Mm. He says,
foreshadowing.
Right. Scientific progress was made possible by all of our actions in March and April. We stayed home, we distanced. To everyone did, thank you, you saved lives. Now, there is an important question about that behavior. Was it done to protect ourselves or also to protect the people around us,
mm-hmm.
right? And he says, here's the question. If the transmission rate was very high, Do we live in a society where young, white, healthy people would be just as cautious as black and brown people, older people and sicker people? In other words, the people who are most susceptible to this, right? And he says, to keep it simple, would lower risk people wear a $1 mask to dramatically cut down on transmission, knowing they were going to come into contact with higher risk people or their family members, even if they weren't worried for themselves?
Right.
Or would they say, let me live my mask-free life to the fullest. The high-risk people can take care of themselves and isolate. And then he asks, can people working essential jobs perfectly isolate?
Right.
Should they have to, right, if a month with a mask for everyone is an alternative? And then he continues, let's not pull punches here. In other countries, they faced this question, and society has rallied. All over Asia, Europe, and Oceania, people have worn masks, locked down, sacrificed income, and stayed away from bars. It wasn't easy, and they might have to do it again, but it worked. It is becoming clearer and clearer that in the United States, we have a situation much more like the second scenario. Young people feel immune, and many are symptom-free. White people have lower mortality than black and brown people, and well-off people can isolate.
Mm-hmm.
But they all can easily spread COVID-19 to those people who are at higher risk.
Yep.
And he says, we all likely know by now that black Americans are twice as likely to die of COVID-19 as white people.
Wow.
But if you're between 35 and 44, black Americans are 9 times more likely to die of COVID-19 as white people in that age group, right?
Oh my gosh.
Which is, I mean, that's you and me, right?
Yeah.
And our peers. And then he continues, the likelihood of catching and the severity of the virus goes up as prolonged exposure, as exposure is prolonged, and the number of people you're exposed to does.
Right.
You know, quick running into a grocery store without a mask is different from working in a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
But simple things like wearing a mask, not attending large events like casinos and churches, not hanging out in bars, protect everyone.
Yep.
And cut down on transmission.
Yeah.
The 9 out of the 10 cities with the highest growth in transmission are in places with low reported mask use, right? I mean, obviously, there's a relationship there.
Yeah.
And so he poses the question, what is the matter with us? Why do we need to personally be at risk to care about risk to others, right? If I told you, he says, if I told you there was a force that preyed on the old, the sick, and people of color, you might refer to it as a Nazi disease, right?
Oh, gosh.
Right? Which is a vivid metaphor. He says, as the death rate drops and people feel safer, lower risk people will be even more cavalier about getting back to their lives. I mean, that's just an observation. We're seeing that playing out in real time.
Yeah.
And he concludes with this stunning observation. He says, science is not our missing ingredient in beating this virus. Empathy is.
Good Lord.
Right?
Yeah.
Which really, I mean, this whole thing, I mean, I quoted from it at length because the whole thing just felt like a body blow to me, you know?
Yeah.
Because it feels just undeniably true. Like it has that resonance of truth in the saddest of ways, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Sad, I mean, and I say sad because I was raised with this myth of America, like so many people our age, so many people who were born in the in the 70s, right?
Yep.
Because really, like, in the 70s, in the early through mid, even late 70s, we were really at the tail end of maybe the best time in American civic life.
For some people.
For some people, right? and that's a fair comment. But the esprit de corps, you know, that was generally felt, the ability to come together around shared purposes, you know, that was really sort of at its apex in World War II.
Right.
You know, we were at the tail end of that in the 70s. It really changed with Reagan's election and all the sort of the societal shift that happened around that he was sort of a symptom and then a further cause of,
right,
you know. But we were raised, you and I, and people our age, with this myth of America as this place where people do the right thing and where we come together to fight impossible foes, you know?
Right.
That World War II reality of, you know, people are like complaining about wearing masks right now for a few months. And like, our grandparents had to have ration books for what they were allowed to buy at the grocery for years.
Right.
You
because
know?
To support, in support of the war effort.
Yeah.
Like, Yeah.
It's just wild. Like, if you wanted fresh vegetables, you kind of had to grow them yourself.
Victory Gardens.
You know? Yeah. It was like a whole thing that society did together.
Yeah.
And people didn't bitch and moan about it. People were proud in their role as individual Americans being part of this project called America, this thing that we do together, this thing that we create together. And there was a sense of pride that I've heard about, you know?
Right.
And that was really instilled in me from, you know, my parents, because they grew up in that, you know? My parents were born in the 40s. Mm-hmm. And so they were raised in the absolute best of the post-war feeling of camaraderie for white people that this country could have.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, and you're right about that. And that's really important to note.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's just not a thing anymore.
Yeah, it's a myth. I hear you say that it was a thing, and yes, for some segments of the society, it was.
Yeah.
That was the mentality. But even the prosperity that came, and the share, you know, the coming together to build whatever came after World War II, only a certain segment of the population got to benefit from that. You know, so even then, it's not like folks were working for the good of everyone.
No,
because that was not a reality even then.
Yeah, just don't pay attention to that 10% of the population.
Well, yeah, and that's, I mean, but the myths go on and on, right? You can go back to the founding of the country. Like the history that we're taught is, you know, about all this American pride and like our founding fathers and, you know, they're not teaching us the part of the true ugliness of the slave trade. I mean, like, I was not taught in school.
No.
I was not taught in school that literally the mechanism for immense wealth building in this country was built on the stolen labor of enslaved black people.
Yep.
It was like, I was taught, and I left, you know, my education with this myth that it was just this great American spirit of going out and building something new on your own, you know, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. Baloney.
Yeah.
That never happened.
Rugged individualism.
That's never been, it's always been a myth.
Yeah.
That we are a proud people who come together to do hard things. No, I can't tell you now that I've had my eyes opened to the hidden parts of our history that there's ever been a time where that's been true.
Yep.
But we've bought the lie
forever.
And like this opportunity we have right now, like the coalescence of the coronavirus and the just rampant inequality in which we're seeing how it is playing out in the lives of people mm-hmm. in our country. And like you're saying, now the response to, you know, people are having toward, oh, it's no big deal. I'm not really at risk. I don't have to really do my part, you know. That coalescing with this racial justice movement that mm-hmm. that has been such a wave, this is an opportunity for us to actually start to make good on what we have believed to be the promises of America that have never been the case.
Right.
We've never lived up to equality and justice for all.
We have a chance to make these amazing PR slogans realities.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the PR, like America's PR is super, super good.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the whole land of the free, home of the brave thing, you know? It's so weird, right? Like, home of the brave seems to get interpreted a lot more along the lines of I can have guns. You know, and a lot less along the lines of I will make personal sacrifice.
I will wear a mask to protect my fellow citizens.
I will wear a mask out of doors as much as an hour a day.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. So this, yeah, what's wrong with us, as Andy Slavitt said?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, like thinking about, you know, the first thing, the idea of consumption masked as purpose, and then this Andy Slavitt thread here that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The connecting point between those two things really, to me, and tell me if you disagree, feels as though it's a spiritual emptiness that we're currently experiencing in our country.
What do you mean by spiritual emptiness? Because like that word can be like a for some people like me.
Spiritual, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't mean anything to do with like God or anything like
okay.
that because I'm an atheist.
Yeah.
I mean it in the classic sense of the word, having to do with the spirit.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
It just seems like there's kind of, I mean, part of it feels like a moral bankruptcy, but that really feels more related to the second part, you know, the just utter lack of concern about looking out for our fellow people,
mm-hmm.
you know. It's just not a moral way to conduct one's life. And mm-hmm. I was raised with morals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't raised with religion, but I was raised with morals,
sure.
you mm-hmm. know.
Yeah.
And there's overlap there. There can be. But, you know, the idea of spiritual emptiness to me really hinges more on the idea that like you just like it seems like there's a lot of people in our country that just don't have principles that guide like a core of principles from which they then make thoughts and decisions about like individual things. Like if you have ethics and principles and a solid moral core, mm-hmm. then you will approach everything in your life with that and you'll make decisions on a one-by-one basis. Mm-hmm. You know, how should I act in this situation? Let me try to do the next right thing. Let me try mm-hmm. to do what's best. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily seeing a whole lot of what's the next right best thing to do, you know, exhibited by my fellow citizens.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't seem there's a lot of reflection. It doesn't seem like there's a lot really of anything but tribalism, you know?
Yeah.
Like what am I hearing on Fox News? Mm-hmm. What am I hearing from my terrible neighbor? Whatever yeah. it is, mm-hmm. you know? What is my tribe doing, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, I hear that and I don't disagree with you. I think that I'll add to that bucket mm-hmm. the notion of we are an extraordinarily self-centered society.
Yeah.
And I have a couple things to say about this. You know, it goes along with the sort of lack of a moral core because, like, if the moral core is defined around, well, how am I going to better my own situation? Then that's a moral core
It's a core. I would disagree that it's a moral core.
It is. Well, okay. I guess I'm...
It's an organizing principle.
That's what I'm saying. It's a way that, you know, a person can organize their own priorities.
Sure.
You know, and it's tempting for all of us, right, to be self-centered in our decision-making and how we live our lives and all that kind of stuff. But I think that it is pervasive in our society, the self-centeredness. And I, you know, there's a couple of threads I'm pulling from this right now in my brain. The first one is related to the phrase personal responsibility, right? That's a phrase I grew up hearing a lot when I was sort of being sort of ingrained with this idea that each of us is responsible for ourselves and everybody's got to take personal responsibility for their lives. Mm-hmm. And what I understand that to be now is a phrase that is attempting to absolve the person using it from any responsibility for anyone else around them.
No responsibility to the collective whole.
Exactly. Because if you've got personal responsibility, then whatever problems you're having, that coronavirus you just got and that you're more susceptible to because you're older, sicker, or black or brown, not my problem. Because right. I'm taking my own personal responsibility. That's your problem. Mm-hmm. You should be dealing with that. So there's that.
It's like a really screwed up... Like through the looking glass version of Sides of the Street, but like not in a healthy way.
Exactly. Right. Yes. So there's that. And the other thread that I'm pulling from this is that in a lot of ways, the way that we have structured our society, and this relates back to the first Twitter quote that you were mentioning earlier about yeah. this, you know, what was it? It was the consumption masked as purpose. Mm-hmm. Idea, you know, going back to our experience in Target, feeling comforted by the consumer goods. We live in a society that for decades has been built on this notion of consumption and that like you're living a good life if you're able to consume all that you want and need.
Yeah.
And
the bigger house, the bigger car, the more expensive this and that.
The fancier this or that. And it's a society that is diseased at its core with self-centeredness because yeah. it's all about what's more for me, more for me, more for me.
Total.
At the expense of less for you, less for you, less for you.
Right.
That's what this capitalist society is like.
Total side note.
Someone's
here.
Wealth is based on someone else's oppression in this system that we currently live in.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really funny. I saw this headline this week in Bloomberg. So, I mean, it's a business-related publication. But the headline, like, it showed a graph of, like, wages and corporate profits used to track one another really tightly. You know what uh-huh. I mean? But, like, in the last...
Like, when one would go up, the other would go up, and yeah. one would go down, the other
and
would go down.
And in the last, like, 35, 40 years, they've diverged wildly with corporate profits soaring up and wages and you know, the outcomes for workers remaining more or less flat. And the Bloomberg headline was, why the discrepancy? There's no good answers. And I was like, yeah.
There's lots of good answers.
Yeah, it's a mystery. Where did it all go,
where
Bloomberg?
Where did it? Where indeed? Yeah. But so I guess my thought here, though, just to bring it back to sort of like the empathy question is that we're living in a society that we all built that's based on getting more for yourself at the expense of less for others. This is the system. This is the rat wheel we're all chasing on and have been since the day we were born in this country or the day we came to this country. Mm-hmm. And it's not healthy for any of us. Yeah. Like, but literally the whole system is about to collapse because of it. Mm-hmm. And what are we going
to
do?
Right. It's a myth of rugged individualism coming home to roost in a big, huge way right now.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. It's funny. Like, that is something that always instinctively, when I was a kid, always felt a little, like, it's alluring, right? The idea of rugged individualism, the John Wayne ethos, you know, one man, never a woman, one man out there making his way, damn the consequences, you know? Mm. And it always felt weird to me, you know? I was never, like, the most, I don't know, I was never the most stereotypically masculine little kid anyway, you know what I mean? And part of me when I was growing up just thought that it was because I was sort of a beta male, you know, and I sort of took some shame on because of that. I was like, because I didn't resonate with the rugged American individual like myth, because that didn't really resonate within me. I kind of thought that was my fault, that that was bad. That was something I was doing wrong because I was kind of like small and scrawny and weak and couldn't hold my own in a physical fight and, you know, and kind of felt like I was being a bad American in a way.
Gosh.
You know?
Or a bad male.
Yeah, or both, you know? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the idea of American maleness, A, and American rugged individualism, B, are just both horribly toxic and terrible.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what if it were, what if the idea of what it is to be the best possible American was that it's the version of an American who works the hardest to make sure that everyone in his community is doing well?
Yep.
What if that were the goal?
Yep.
That would be nice.
That would be nice. Here's the thing. The system we live in is not permanent. It has not existed forever and will exist forever. Yeah. It's temporary. We invented it, we being the human race who occupy this continent.
Yeah.
We can change it. We can do something different. It's wild that we're living in a time where it might actually be possible given how shaken up things have gotten. Goodness gracious, I hope they don't have to get shaken up even more for us to get the picture that this is the time for us to start building something different.
Yeah.
Because it's been painful for a lot of people. Yeah. But maybe now's the beginning of something new.
Yeah. You know, we can hope. It seems, and I don't want to sound pessimistic, but it does feel overly optimistic to be like, wow, 2020 is going to be pretty tough, but 2021, new horizons.
Right.
There are problems ingrained so deep in our country, so deep in our society that I think, and first of all, even if there is a popular groundswell, which I do think there is, to change how things are, the forces that have the way things are in place are not going to go quietly, and they are immensely powerful.
Yeah.
Immensely powerful.
Yeah.
And have been in place for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these structures were imported from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like this is a 200-year-old American problem.
Mm-mm.
This is a thousands of years old human problem
mm-hmm.
that we have just kind of in America, we sort of created in America a couple of hundred years ago, like a weird laboratory for how to do things in the most fucked up possible way. Like, what if we had an immense amount of space that we stole from other people to do every single possible most antisocial thing we could do for 200 years, and that's how we started a society.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that said, there are some good ideas about democracy, right? Like, if we had been a country that was actually founded on the ideals we say we were, it would be a different story. And those things I think are still worth trying for.
Sure.
You know?
I do think it should be a lot closer to a direct democracy than a representative democracy, right? It's so funny. I saw the most pithy quote from someone a few days ago. They're like, hey, since we're all in the mood right now to take down monuments to slavery, how about the Electoral College?
Heck yeah, that is a monument to slavery. Look it up. that's so true. You know, this, what you were just describing before, that's like, this is going to require a sustained effort. We had this whole other part of the podcast planned out to talk about sustained effort, but I feel like we got so deep into this part. Let's push pause on that till next week, because we want to get to the second half of today's podcast. But yeah, sustained effort, maybe next week we'll pick that back up. Mm-hmm. But you're right. It's going to require a long-term commitment to this project.
Yeah. And primarily from comfortable white people.
Yeah.
Because it's ours to fix.
Yeah.
So that's foreshadowing, people.
Uh-huh.
So what do you think? Should we take a little break and then come back and delve into some happy music time?
Let's do that.
All right, cool.
See you soon.
Back in a sec. I did an enthusiastic and we're back because it's music time now.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
In our Misfit Stars private Facebook group, our star Katie mm-hmm. asked last week, what do you guys do during the break? And the answer was very unexciting. I go to the bathroom.
And sometimes I do too.
Yeah.
And also, honestly, it's just because we know as podcast listeners ourselves that like, it's hard when there's like a really long, uninterrupted podcast. Because what if you need to go pee? Or
yeah.
What if you have to do an email or something comes up? Like, you want to have moments built in where you can pause and there's like a good natural place to do so. So we're providing that for you, dear listener.
Also, I would be
Did you go pee?
I would be doing the pee-pee dance for the entire second part of the podcast if we didn't take the break.
So. Yep. Shannon's got a bladder like a walnut, people. I'm here to tell you. So, so we're going to start walking everyone through our new album.
Dive into the album.
It's called, so first of all, the album is called And Her Whisper Becomes a Storm. And do you want to talk a little bit to start with about your process for this record?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds great. So I had this idea formulating over the winter months, the fall and winter months, as my brain always starts thinking, okay, what are you going to write about next? What's the thing that's like, most present in my mind, mm-hmm. on my heart, that I feel compelled to write about.
Yeah.
And each year it's a different sort of theme. This last fall and winter, I just got this idea that I would really love to explore the idea of doing the next right thing and what that feels like and looks like for me in my life. It's a tool that I pull out all the time that has really helped me to sort of orient my actions and my idea of my purpose in my mm-hmm. life and the direction I'm headed. And
sobriety tools, people. They work.
They do. And so I had this idea, and for whatever reason, the title, the title of the record is the first thing I wrote for the record.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
by the way, people, is often the last.
It's yeah.
Often you write the body of work and then you figure out what the connecting themes are and then you kind of reverse engineer, okay, what should the title be, Shannon often works in a really different and much more intentional, much more thematic way.
Right. Well, but even then, every album we've done so far before this one, we've come up with a title after the songs were written.
Yes.
So even if I knew sort of generally what the theme was going to be, like, the actual title wasn't written. So this is the first. I wrote the title first, and it was a phrase that came to me, and it sort of represented this idea of what happens when you start with the listening, the getting still, and what is the potential for that,
mm-hmm.
As you move forward through the steps. And so I wrote the title first, and I had this idea if I'm going to write an album about doing the next right thing, would it be interesting to approach writing the album in sequential order, like from the beginning to the end,
mm-hmm.
which is again not something that people normally do when they're writing records. They mm-hmm. usually just write a bunch of songs and then figure out, how they sound good together as a collection. Oh, this would be a good song one, and that would be a good song four. And here's let's end the album with this song. So I just thought it would be interesting to sort of like not, and it's not like I wanted to like challenge myself with like the task of doing this. I thought it would be an interesting experiment to put the actual songwriting process through the rigors of doing one thing mm-hmm. and then listening for what the next thing ought to be and then doing that.
Yeah.
And then listening for what the next thing ought to be and doing that, you know?
Amazing. So, people, this is like a masterclass level songwriting exercise, by the way. I've been producing records for 25 years and I've literally never heard of anybody else doing this. It's mind-blowing to me. It's hard enough to write a good record, period. But to write not just a good record, but a great record and write it sequentially. It's just like, how do you even do that?
But again, it's not like I was trying to be like, I'm going to achieve this feat. Like that wasn't my purpose, my point in it. My point was just...
Doesn't matter. You still did.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you. I appreciate your compliments. But like the point of it was like, what would happen if I did it this way? You know, like let's put this theory to test
right.
in a meta kind of way as I create this album. Mm-hmm. And it was a really interesting journey. Like I wrote the title. And then the first song from the record, which we're going to play today, sort of became a bit of an overture, I guess, for the album itself. Mm-hmm. But I had this idea that the first song would maybe be could maybe be a representation of what the whole journey feels like from the beginning, the mm-hmm. small whisper to the storm mm-hmm. at the end, and that maybe this first song could be a wordless exploration of that arc
yeah.
or that journey, right? And just kind of like setting up like here's the overview
yeah.
of the experience you're about to have on this theme of And Her Whisper Becomes a Storm. And I've never shared this with you, but maybe you'll remember this now that I'm sharing it with you. The melody of that first of the first piece, maybe we should play it first and then I'll tell you this. I'm not sure what
I don't know
do.
What you're saying,
it's
so I
true.
Can't
I'm
weigh in.
Working it out here in real time. No, I'll tell you now. So the melody, as you'll hear when we play the song here in a moment, it's sort of a cyclical. It changes keys, mm-hmm. And it sort of
it goes down a fourth each time.
Yeah, so it changes keys multiple times. The melody stays the same in each new key, but this melody da 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 da. That melody and the chord structure and the key changing that happens with it is something that I wrote years ago.
Is it?
Yeah. And now that I'm telling you about it, it might jog your memory. I used to play it as an intro to one of the earliest songs I wrote when I started very, very first started
really?
doing music as a solo artist.
If I recognize a melodic fragment, I'll recognize it. But
oh.
You telling me about it is not going to jog.
Well, maybe it's possible that I stopped doing that before I met you or before you saw me perform as a solo artist. It's possible
maybe
that it was
even
only
probable because I probably would remember it. Like I don't tend to forget
stuff.
Melodic stuff.
Right. So yeah, this was a piece and I it was never sung. It was only ever played on the piano, that melody as an intro to one of my early, early demo songs. Like it's a song that exists on maybe, What is the song? Oh, I can't think of the song now. I can't even remember the song I used to play this as an intro for. It was that long ago.
Wow.
We do have a recording of it somewhere. But anyway, it's been around for a long time. But I remember being in the shower one night thinking about, okay, I got to write the first song for this album. And I remember thinking about this melody. And I'm like, what would be interesting if I just did a vocal version of that and developed it into this, you know, sort of overture theme. And that's where it came from.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, should I play it now?
Yeah, let's hear it.
All right, people, this is the love theme from And Her Whisper Becomes a Storm.
The love theme. Maybe the title song.
Right. Yeah. It's the overture, maybe.
Yeah.
It's called And Her Whisper Becomes a Storm.
Mm-hmm. 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 The end.
The end. That's great. And then they all gathered in a ballroom and the chandelier fell on them. The end.
Oh, that was out of nowhere.
Yeah, that's an example of, if you're not a very good writer, how to write the ending for your book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Very good.
Yeah, just an elaboration really on what you were doing there. And that's the song.
And that's it. You know, it's funny, like, there was no reason for me to have this melody pop in my head in the shower that one night. Like, it's I haven't thought about it in years. Mm-hmm. Like, I literally wrote that in, like, 2005 or 6.
Yeah.
And haven't thought about it since then.
Amazing.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, it became the thing that needed to be the theme of this record. And there you go.
Yeah. This song has been getting an extraordinary amount of reaction, like early reaction from people.
Yeah.
We surprise released this record about a week early into our Misfit Stars private Facebook group. And this song, I mean, out of all the songs on the record, probably got 50% of the initial comments.
I was so surprised
by
that.
And the other 11 songs among them got the other 50%.
Yeah.
Yeah. People were really, and continue to be really taken by this one. And during the live show, I can, like, because we can see everyone's faces on the screens in front of us. Mm-hmm. I have my little iMac in front of me showing my view of Zoom, and you have it mirrored on a TV in front of you. We can both see the people watching. Mm-hmm. People seem to be a little shocked and sometimes a little emotional with this one.
So interesting.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's an intense and emotional thing for sure, but people seem to be having a deeply personal reaction to it, I guess I would say.
Yeah, I wonder if part of that is the wordless nature of it. You can kind of like assign your own ideas to it if there aren't any lyrics guiding you.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah.
I'm very, the wordless nature of the song means that we don't have an episode of Jamie's Bad Lyrics. that we got to give it a title. It's like, what is it? What do you call it? Do you call it?
I haven't thought of it yet.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to have to come up.
I call it Misheard Lyrics.
Misheard Lyrics. Right.
Yeah.
That's a good title.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jamie's Misheard Lyrics.
Yeah.
We won't have it. There's no version of that for this song because there just are no words to mishear.
Yeah.
So I'm a little sad that we have to wait till next week for the first installment of Jamie's Misheard Lyrics.
Well, you know, it's going to be emotional for people. So it's good maybe just to decouple it from the emotional shock of hearing this amazing emotional song first. Okay. I wouldn't want to overwhelm everybody.
Let me give you a little foreshadowing. Jamie's Misheard Lyrics are often irreverent.
Yeah.
Silly.
Yeah.
Sometimes downright rude.
Yeah. Frequently, my favorite sweet spot, honestly, is obtuse.
Yeah.
Like, if there can be a misheard lyric that just makes something really meaningful and emotional just be pedestrian and lame, that's sort of my sweet spot.
Yeah. So you have that to look forward to over the next 11 weeks.
By the way, lame is ableist, and I'm sorry I said it.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, this is going to be a fun series. There's not much more to talk about with this song. There's not much to dig into because I think it's one of those wordless experiences that people can attach their own meaning to.
But clearly are.
Yeah, absolutely. But yes, it was intended to be sort of like here's the journey you're about to go on, sketch. And next week we'll pick up with song 2 on the record and go for another deep dive.
And just an interesting little tidbit here, by the way. The show this year, we're playing this album front to back.
Right.
First time we've ever done that. And we're playing no other songs. There's not any songs in the show that aren't on this record. The show just is this record.
Yep.
With expanded storytelling.
Yeah.
About another 18 or so minutes of storytelling to make a 42-minute album into about a 60-minute show.
Yeah.
Which is, it's actually a really sweet spot. We wanted to keep a little more concise the show this year just because we didn't quite know
the
whole Zoom thing, what would attention spans be like. It seems like a great length.
Mm-hmm.
But also because we've been doing like 75 to 80 minute shows for a few years now, it just feels like it's over before it begins for us.
You know, totally.
Like it's done already.
Yeah.
But it's great. The show really goes. And really for a record that's about doing the next right thing and that was written in such an intentional, sequential fashion, it really would be inappropriate to put any other songs in there or to perform it in any other way, I think.
Totally.
Yeah.
No, yeah. It had to be this way.
Mm-hmm.
Right on. Well, thanks for listening. And thank you all for tuning in to our podcast this week.
Very much. So people, here's the deal. If you do not yet have your copy of And Her Whisper Becomes a Storm, I mean, first of all, music is free. So just like go get it, you know? You can listen to it on any streaming service anywhere in the world. If you're in the US, you could listen to it on Spotify or Apple Music or Tidal. If you're in France, listen to it on Deezer. If you're in the Middle East, we have a streaming service that's on there for you too. It's literally everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
So just go find it. Click play. That's all there is to it these days. That thing David Bowie said in 1997 about in the future, music's just going to be a utility, like turning on a tap. Well, this is that.
We've arrived in David Bowie's future.
Go turn on the tap and enjoy our music for free, because that's what our music apparently is worth in this strange, weird commodity.
But no, because we have this amazing community of people who supports the work that we do.
Well, that's it.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
The music can exist for free, 50 free, out in the streaming verse, because we have a community of people who supports the work that we do in an ongoing kind of way.
Yeah.
That is largely centered in our Misfit Stars patron community.
Yep.
Thank you so much to all of you who are members of the Misfit Stars.
Yep.
If you would like to become part of that group of people that does that, you can join it at misfitstars.com/join.
That's the way that you can, in your own personal way, assign a value to the work that we do,
yeah,
right? It used to be, back in the 80s and 90s, that you would be like, you know what? I do think that this record is worth $11.49 a tower, and I am going to plunk down my $11.49, and that's that transactional nature of that, right?
Right.
And the interesting thing about this weird new music economy is that the transactionality has been largely removed from the music consumption experience, because the actual music itself is just freely available.
Right.
Meaning that if you want to value it, you have to explicitly do so, and you've got to think about that more.
Right.
Which I kind of honestly like, because what it does is it forces you, the listener, to really actively grapple with concepts like, well, what is art worth in my world?
Man.
Do I want this to continue? Do I want a world where stuff like this continues to perpetuate and is funded? Well, if you do, you got to fund it now.
That's right.
That's a deal.
100% circles back to our conversation from the first half of this podcast episode, too, in terms of, what does it mean to consume?
Yeah.
And what is our role in a society? Like, what do we want it to look like? You know?
So maybe, just maybe, Spotify is actually leading away forward out of a consumption-oriented paradigm toward one of actual intentional valuation of artistic experiences.
Spotify is
They're doing it by taking away all our money, which is a weird way to do it.
Spotify is like the coronavirus in this analogy.
Wow. Yeah. Spotify is like a virus in a lot of analogies, I think.
You know what? Whatever the landscape of music consumption and all that looks like, the bottom line is that I am grateful for our community who very enthusiastically rallies around us and does support and sustain what we do. Thank you
so much
to all of you who do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're very grateful for you. We literally could not continue to do what we do, particularly in this pandemic time, without you.
That's true.
Our community is the entire reason that we are living indoors and eating food right now.
Hey, and if you do want an actual copy of the record, you can buy it. And we'll be sending out CDs starting like next week or so.
They were shipped 2 days ago.
Amazing. So we're going to be mailing out CDs to our Misfit Stars community, those of you who've asked for them. And if you want to buy one, you're welcome to do that at shannoncurtis.net.
Yep. Also, everyone who's in the Misfit Stars group just gets a free CD mailed to them from our house if they want one.
That's right.
So if you're a smart person right now, you might be putting this together and going, wait a minute. I can sign up for Misfit Stars for $5 and I can get a CD sent to me.
That's right.
Yeah, friend.
Smart.
Yeah, you can.
Smart move.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, something to think about there. Anything else? We good?
That's all I got.
All right. Thanks for the good conversation.
Hey, you too.
Yeah.
Thank you all for listening.
Very much. And if you would like to become a supporter of what we do, please do that. We would appreciate it. We could use it. Misfitstars.com/join is the place to do that. Thank you in advance for those of you who decide to do that. We will be back next week. And, you know, here's hoping that it's not too much of a wild ride between now and then in our country. I'm not optimistic, but I'm hopeful.
Take good care of yourselves in the meantime. We'll have more goodies to talk about next week, and we'll have our next installment into diving into this record with you too, which will be fun.
Very exciting.
So, until then, so long.
We love you guys.
Be well.
See ya.
Bye.